It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum number 34. And as usual, this week we're going to take in events around the world and look at them from a Christian perspective. And there's just so much going on and so much that would cause us to be burdened. I feel a particular burden this week because as you are listening to this, I will be in hospital undergoing an operation, and I value your prayers for that. But given my previous experience, I'm afraid that I'm always very wary of these things, but they're in the Lord's hands, as are all the events that are going on throughout the world. And this week we begin with, I think, the biggest story of the week. Although it's received some coverage, it's not been massive, but that is Cyclone Idai.
The water consumes the land, homes, belongings, and lives. This is 15 miles from the coast, but has become an inland sea. Today, as the rain cleared, we were able to fly over one part of the flooded interior. Over people waiting for food, water, and medical aid. Some sought refuge in the stands of a stadium. Here, crowded onto a bridge. It leads to a cathedral, one of many buildings battered by the cyclone. Others have camped on roofs. Hundreds have already been rescued from here, but many more are still in desperate need.
It's reckoned to be the biggest storm ever to have hit the southern hemisphere, according to some in the UN. In Beira, 90% of all buildings have been damaged. Over 300 people are dead. 1.5 million people are threatened. Now, with all the troubles that many of us face, and troubles that we face within terms of our own country, economies, and so on, bear a thought for these people, because they have troubles far beyond the things that we complain about. And I thank the Lord for those who are there working to help and to restore and to recover. But today I think it's good for us to begin by remembering and praying for and seeking to help those people who have been so devastated by this storm. Let's turn to one of the other big stories of the week, and that is the question of the New Zealand mosque shootings. Now, I've written about it, and we put a link to that. We have links to all of these stories on the website. And there's so much that one could say, and there's so much that one shouldn't say. Just the sheer horror of it. I agree, however, entirely with the New Zealand Prime Minister Ardern, who refuses to name the killer. I think that's spot on. I think in many of these kind of school shootings and terror attacks, there are individuals who are motivated by a variety of reasons, but one of them is fame. You deny them the oxygen of publicity, and I think that you help undermine those who perhaps would seek to take advantage of it, or you lessen the chance of it being repeated elsewhere. So I think in that she was absolutely spot on, and overall she has carried herself with dignity. Now, there are one or two aspects of this in terms of the wider situation that I think are helpful. So listen to what the Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon had to say.
The Muslim community in Glasgow feels the pain of what happened in New Zealand, just as the New Zealand community would have done if this had happened elsewhere. It is a global community in many respects. So although New Zealand is very, very far away on the other side of the world, it does feel to Muslims here and elsewhere, I'm sure, very close to home and very personal. And it's important to me as First Minister of Scotland that we stand shoulder to shoulder with our community, and also that we are unequivocal in our condemnation, not just of this attack, but of the hatred and the ideology that motivates attacks like this one?
No, I think I have no objection at all to the First Minister going and visiting a mosque. None whatsoever, actually. Or expressing solidarity or expressing concern. And I do think that there are significant concerns for many who are Muslims. And I think it's right for us as Christians to defend the right of Muslims to peacefully gather for worship, even if we disagree with their theology and their practice. However, what bothers me about this a little bit is this. In the past 3 weeks, 120 Christians were killed in Nigeria by Islamists. Something that incidentally was not reported in the New York Times. I don't think it was reported in the Times, the Scotsman, or others as well. This week, 32 were killed on the 19th of March. Yesterday, 9 more in Nigeria, 6 in the Congo. And what I want to know is this. Why has our First Minister not gone to, say, the church I was in last Sunday, one of the 80 mainly Nigerian churches in Scotland? Why not? Why has there not been the outrage against these killings? Why has there not been the publicity? And that really is a genuine question. Nicola Sturgeon said we need to confront the hatred and ideology that motivates these killers. We need to root it out. Indeed. But why won't she name the hatred and the motivation of people who've killed over 2,000 this year alone? Not 50, but 2,000. In other words, the Islamist. Because she's scared of being called Islamophobic. And so, for example, the Runnymede Trust have pushed this idea of Islamophobia to the extent that to be critical of Islam at all, to suggest, for example, it may be anti-woman or incompatible with Western liberal values, is to be guilty of hate crime. And that's why one of the ridiculous aftermaths of the New Zealand mosque shootings have been the number of people and newspapers and serious journalists who've said, well, it's columnists who are to blame. People who are opposed to Islam in any way whatsoever are ultimately responsible for the mosque shootings in New Zealand. Well, again, listen to what our friend Brendan O'Neill has to say about this. I think he's spot on.
What we've seen since the Christchurch massacre is a really cynical, quite ghoulish attempt to use this racist mass murder to force through new forms of censorship and to make people feel bad for simply raising criticisms or concerns about radical Islam or about Islam in general. I think people ought to have the right to speak freely, to write freely, to think freely, including about things like ISIS and the rise of radical Islam and the spread of Islamist terrorism, which in Europe has claimed around 500 lives over the past few years. These are things we ought to talk about. We should talk about the causes of these problems. And I'm very worried about the way in which the word Islamophobia is now used simply to demonize people who hold difficult or different opinions about the issue of Islam.
And then, speaking of hate speech, let's go to what President Erdogan has said about Australia and New Zealand. I mean, this is really quite spectacular. The Turkish leader has used the New Zealand killings as a centerpiece in his political campaign. This is what he said. He's talking about Gallipoli. Your grandfathers came and saw that we're here. Then some of them walked back while others left in coffins. If you come with the same intention, we'll be waiting for you. And what's he talking about? He's talking about people that he perceives to be anti-Islamist. Is that not hate speech? I'm still waiting for the condemnation of that to occur from Ms. Sturgeon and others. And yet another aspect of this story, and again, I'm not looking for this, but it does genuinely puzzle me. This week in Utrecht, 3 people were killed by an ISIS fighter. Now, when it was initially reported, there were suggestions that he knew somebody and that this was not a terrorist attack, although it occurred on a tram in Utrecht, but it was an individual who was killing somebody he knew and then killed two bystanders who tried to intervene. But that apparently is not the story. They've discovered in his car terrorist messages, basically Islamist messages. Now, what strikes me again about that story is how little publicity it has received. So a week after the New Zealand massacres, it's still headline news here. But within a day of the Utrecht, it wasn't even being mentioned. And again, the numerous politicians and journalists and commentators who commentated lengthy things about the New Zealand mosque have said nothing about this. Where are the outraged tweets? Where are the statements in The Guardian and the Scottish Government? Who's confronting the hatred that caused this man to go out and kill three innocent Dutch civilians? I think there's a real paradox here. And this is not a case of whataboutry. Look, we can justify the killings in New Zealand because what about Muslims killing people elsewhere? This is a case of saying that surely in a just society and in a compassionate society, we're going to condemn killings wherever they occur. And if we're talking about rooting out hatred in one section of the community, then we also need to talk about it in another. And yet, our confused and messed up leaderships have got into such a state that when an Islamist commits a crime, we're told not to demonize a whole group. We're told, don't look back in anger. Remember that after the Manchester bombings? But when it's a white supremacist, as the New Zealand killer appears to have been, although he was also, by the way, an eco-warrior, an extreme environmentalist, and I don't think we're blaming the Green Party, we're told we must root out the ideology. We really are in a dreadful mess when there's such inconsistency. Incidentally, just one more comment on this whole area, and that's with Utrecht. As it happens, IFES under Lindsey Brown are conducting a university mission in Utrecht this week. That surely is the only hope for our cultures, any culture in the world. It's to bring the hope and the glory of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. Okay, let's move on to something that's just obsessing the political classes here and the people I think are fed up, and that is, of course, Brexit. Now, I get asked about this quite a lot from people from other countries saying what is going on, and as I always try to explain, the people of the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union. In general, the politicians of the United Kingdom and the media and arts and business establishments don't want to. And so what we're getting played out at the moment is this irresistible force meets the immovable object. And what has happened in the past week is that we have the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, announcing that he will not allow the government to bring its deal for a third time to Parliament. That's created a huge fuss. We're due to be leaving on the 29th of March. The government have applied to the EU for an extension of 3 months. That's upset the EU. It's upset those who want us to remain. And therefore, they want a longer extension. And so the battle goes on, and it seems as though we're absolutely stuck. I am still of the view that we will not leave the EU to any real extent. But who knows what will happen. It is an absolute mess, and it's an indication of the lack of leadership and the dissonance between the people of this country and its political leaders. Now, part of the reason for this is the way that our society, and I'm talking here about in the United Kingdom, is becoming fundamentally anti-Christian, especially amongst its establishment. So this week we've had the extraordinary story of an Iranian Christian who has been refused an application for asylum in the UK by the Home Office because the Home Office doesn't believe that they've been converted and cites as that, basically having Googled it and picked it up off Bible Gateway. They've cited various passages in the Bible which show that Christianity is not a peaceful religion. So our Iranian brother had said that he converted to Christianity when he realized that Islam wasn't peaceful and that Christianity was, and he turned to Jesus Christ. And the Home Office have basically pronounced that on the basis of a quote from Revelation and various other parts that he doesn't know his own faith, and that that they've also cited verses of the Quran that speak about peace. Now, it's just what astounds me about this. It's the breathtaking ignorance of it, as well as the prejudice, which of course ignorance often fuels, and the discrimination. But this is in Britain. This is not in Iran. This is not in communist China. This is in Britain. Now, as one of my Iranian friends said to me, you know, it'd be so much easier if we just said we were gay, and then we'd be fine. Now, another example of where we're going in this society, and it is increasingly totalitarian, where the state is replacing God, and where language can be changed according to the whims of those who are in power. And that is the case of the Catholic journalist, Caroline Farrow, who's I've got a lot of admiration for in different ways. And she is being interviewed under caution by Surrey police because apparently she referred to the adult child of Susie Green, who is male, but now identifies as female, apparently used the wrong pronoun. Now, Susie Green is the chairperson, I'm not even sure what I should say there, the chairperson of Mermaids, a charity, inverted commas, supporting transgender, which received £500,000 from the government and is being used to indoctrinate our children in queer theory and this horrendous ideology. So she reported her to the police, even though the tweet is not there. It's gone. Caroline Farrow's tweets disappear automatically after 2 weeks, even though Caroline can't even remember what it was. The important thing is this, that here we have a journalist being investigated by the police for something she wrote, which is true. This is the police state that we are getting into. And you can look at some of the things that Susie Green has said and that Jackie Green has said. And you can see exactly where we are going. It's just as simple as this. An investigation has been launched into a journalist for speaking something that someone finds hateful, that's their perception, but which is true. Oh, brave new world. And again, if you wonder where our culture is going, listen to this clip from the House of Commons this week.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I know the Prime Minister campaigned to keep Section 28, which banned LGBT people being talked about positively in schools and led to millions of young people like myself growing up in fear of being LGBT. I thought the Prime Minister had seen the error of her ways, but this morning the Leader of the House said on radio that parents should decide when they're exposed to LGBT education. This is Conservative Party dog whistle politics. Will the Prime Minister condemn the Leader of the House? Will she condemn bigots that don't want LGBT people to be heard in schools? And will she support Ofsted with good LGBT education in our schools?
That is the Labour MP Lloyd Russell Moyle. And what he says is utterly astonishing. Because he says, he asks the Prime Minister to condemn the Leader of the House for suggesting that parents have the right to educate their children according to their own beliefs. He wants to impose, he's it's a basic right recognized by the United Nations, recognized by the European courts, recognized by the British courts as well, that parents have an a priori right to educate their children according to their beliefs. But such is the tyranny of the LGBT philosophy that they want to impose it upon everybody else, and they want to take that right away from parents. Now, we've reached a stage where we've had a case in the past couple of weeks of a child, a 15-year-old child, who's been taken away from her parents because they refuse to accept the transgender change that she wants. So here we have the state taking away children from parents. Again, you can see the authoritarian aspect of this. Now, one of the things that really depresses me about this is that there are, how will I put it, people who profess to be Christians, even evangelical Christians, who are going along with this state doctrine, who are bowing the knee to Caesar rather than to Christ and his word. One such is Jane Ozanne. Now, Jane Ozanne is a former evangelical, she would still describe herself as an evangelical, who, like Vicky Beeching and Steve Chalk, has become a leading advocate for this. But where Jane is particularly dangerous is that she wants to limit and to harm those of us who disagree with her point of view. So she wrote this extraordinary article in which she says that I am a great believer in the importance of promoting a society that enables freedom of speech to the point that it does no harm. If there is clear evidence of harm, then we have a duty of care to protect. Now, here's the trouble. Jane, in a position of power, is saying, well, if you question LGBT, if you question the philosophy of queer theory, then you are harming people. And you see what happens there. Freedom of speech is irrelevant. You're not going to get freedom of speech if you're determined by Jane and her friends in power to be harmful. And you see that even with this new government advisory body. Again, yet another huge amount of money being poured into this one area, where in other areas it's been taken away. But this new government advisory body on LGBT health, you can see who's appointed to it. Not just Jane Ozanne, but James Morton, manager at the Scottish Trans Alliance. Lewis Turner, chief executive of Lancashire LGBT. Paul Martin, chief executive of the LGBT Foundation, Ruth Hunt, chief executive of Stonewall, and so on. Now, the bizarre thing about Jane's article is that she says, well, when people of power are harming others, she's in that power. And that power is all pervasive within our culture. So that even a podcast like this, it won't be too long before I'll be cited as being responsible for hate speech and all the rest of it. Ironically, despite the fact that pastorally I do deal with people who are gay, and I also deal with people who've experienced transgender, and many of whom suffer precisely because of the teachings that Jane Ozanne is advocating. No, Jane, I'm sorry. You won't keep us quiet, and we will continue to speak the word of God, and we won't bow down before your false gods. Okay, before we go to our quote of the week, just a couple of stories that I'll mention because time is running out. Somewhat amusing, perhaps, but indicative. Donald is a very strong Scottish name. Donald MacLeod, Donald MacDonald, and so on. Lots of Donalds I know of. Not anymore. There were only 6 babies named Donald in Scotland last year, and some people reckon this is the Trump effect. On the other hand, there was a child named Lucifer. Yep, that's where we're going. Go to Kentucky. It's good to hear of Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin signing a bill banning abortion based on sex, race, or disability. Excellent news. Whether he's permitted to keep that or to get it through, who knows? Meanwhile, back in the United Kingdom, Cambridge University has shown its credentials. The Faculty of Divinity had invited Jordan Peterson to come and give a series of Bible lectures. His lectures on Genesis have been watched by tens of millions, but now they've withdrawn it on the grounds that he doesn't represent the views or the values of their student body. So ironic, a university banning someone because they don't fit with, they say we believe in freedom of speech, etc., 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 but we can't have someone who doesn't represent our values. This is meant to be one of the top universities in the world, and yes, they are genuinely that thick. Beware, by the way, of the internet in some ways. Do you know this? I wrote in an email something about the colloquy of Regensburg, and on TripAdvisor, I started getting offers of hotels and trips to Regensburg. I mean, it's just amazing how everything we do is watched in different ways. Just absolutely bizarre. Okay, what else do we have for you? Oh yeah, this one story. I just thought it was great. I love cricket. And this week, a great cricket event occurred. The Afghanistan cricket team won for the first time a test match. They beat Ireland. There's a little documentary that I've put a link to on Out of the Ashes, which basically describes how out of war-torn Afghanistan has come this cricket team.
As you know, there is a lot of problems in the world today, you know. In everywhere there is a complex fighting, you know, and injustice things is happening. The solution of all the problem is cricket.
They say cricket is everything. Well, it may not be everything, but it's good that sport can be used in such a healing way. Okay, if you want to support the podcast, then please do go on to our Podbean fundraiser or go onto the website. If you've got any comments, please let me know. If you are a Christian, I value your prayers for this weekend. As I say, as you're listening to this, I will be undergoing an operation almost certainly if you're listening on Friday. I leave you with a quote from John Stott, really quite remarkable, from Balanced Christianity. If you want me to stick my neck out, I think I would say that if the church were officially to approve homosexual partnerships as a legitimate alternative to heterosexual marriage, this so far diverges from biblical sexual ethics that I would find it exceedingly difficult to stay. I might want to stay on and fight a few more years, but if they persisted, I would have to leave. Well, God bless you, and God willing, see you next week. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in a society hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep. We live in this world not of it, gotta be scared and run from it. We shine light in the darkness, that's why he left us here.